The speaker graces didn't agree. I got the tape on now. We can just talk about it for a minute, won't you?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I think Blanford absolutely has the votes, but I just don't know. You know, Bobby's no dummy when it comes to politics and getting things done.
No, he's a pretty, Bobby's a pretty adroit maneuverer.
But you know, there's no reason for a sitting speaker, I think, ever to be in any kind of difficulty. It's kind of like being county clerk.
It oughtn't to be. I have very seldom known a speaker. The last speaker I can recall that had much problem was Shelby McCallum, who really wasn't a very strong speaker and only served one session, didn't he?
Yes, I think that's right.
And he really served only because Ned Breathitt. In those days, the governor had a major impact on the choice of leadership, and Ned was so close to Shelby. They were actually partners in business, you know, owned a radio station together down in Fort Campbell. And Shelby was a very weak speaker, and they dropped him after one session. I guess Bloom was the last one after that. Bloom did serve after he was speaker, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Julian dropped him.
That's right.
Julian picked up Kenton.
That's right.
Of course, this is really the first time we've had a legitimate race, leadership race.
That's right.
Since the governor got out, because even though Blanford ran against Kenton in 79?
Yeah.
That really wasn't a race. Kenton had sold up from the very beginning.
Why, I thought Kenton never was in any danger.
And then Bobby had Mark Farrell run against him 2 years ago at last minute and got 22 votes, which would indicate there's some base out there for Blanford to build on.
Wasn't that sort of a Lloyd Clamp deal?
Well, I think Lloyd put him into it, yeah.
What, Lloyd ran for floor leader, didn't he, or something?
Speaker pro
tem, yeah. And
Blanford beat him.
Well, the very fact that Bobby lost 22 votes indicated that there's at least a hardcore
of discontent. People.
Of discontent, because ordinarily you don't expect a speaker to have much opposition. I don't know why. Bobby never said this to me. At least I don't think he did. But I heard him quoted as saying that he didn't really feel so sad if he wasn't going to be speaker again, that he thought he'd be more effective on the floor than he would be in the chair. And that he would enjoy being back where he could take a more prominent role on the floor. Now, that may be just making the best of a bad situation. But have you ever heard anything like that? Has he ever said anything like that?
Oh, yes. Yes, he has. But
he may have said it to me.
But I will guarantee you this, that Bobby...
He doesn't mean it.
No. No, once the challenge has been made, Bobby's personality is not capable of not accepting the challenge. He may enjoy being back on the floor once he is put there, but he won't enjoy the process of being put there. He may at that time make the best thing out of a bad situation.
I'll say this, if I were speaker and Bobby back on the floor, I would have some apprehensions as to whether my leadership as speaker wouldn't rest on a tenuous foundation part of the time.
Well, of course, that's similar to Kenton's situation with Bloom on the floor. He was quite concerned about that, but Bloom never accommodated himself.
Bloom basically goes with the power. I don't think Bloom likes to be. You know, he had his stint as a kind of rebel way back, and he quickly accommodated himself to the power structure, and I don't think he's ever easy being in opposition anymore, or was. Of course, now he doesn't really count for much. Truth is, there are a lot of members now that Bloom doesn't even know.
Well, that's true. Well, that's going to be interesting. I'm glad we have a year's time between the time they're selected and the time we have a session. Because I think that'll be a good cooling off period, regardless of the outcome.
If we don't have a whole lot of time between now and the time the selection being made.
No. And I'm glad for that, too. I wish we were over with now.
Do you think it's over?
No, I said I wish it were over.
Well, I mean, do you think, in fact, it's over?
No, I don't think you
do. I mean, obviously, it's not legally over.
I don't think it's going to be over until the day the votes are counted.
Won't be over till it's over.
That's right. I think there are some lobbyists who I believe will get into it, and they may, from some back home pressure on some legislators, change some legislators. And maybe some legislators who have committed both sides.
Where do you think Spurrier will be in all this?
Well, he has to have no choice. He's got to be with Richardson.
I would think so.
He has no choice.
I would think so. Although I would guess that he's smooth enough that if Blandford wins it, he'll find a way to make an accommodation.
Well, I'll tell you how he's going to do it. He'll put Sheets on Blandford's side.
Put Sheets on his...
Ron Sheets from RECC, he'll put on Blandford's side.
Mm-hmm.
Which is logical because of, I guess, J.R. Miller connections. Even though Miller's not on, I don't think he's not associated with them. Then the utilities be covered either way.
Yes, and there's no conflict between the RECCs and private utilities anymore, anyhow.
I think they're the most unified industry down there.
That's right. There's no conflict anymore.
Well, let's talk briefly. Let's get an evaluation as of this point. Your evaluation of the Collins administration at this point. And then I want to talk about the Mondale Reagan campaign. And if we have time today, I think I'd like to talk about some education.
Well,
does that suit you okay?
Certainly. Well, you know, it's hard for me to attempt an unbiased evaluation of the Collins administration in many ways. And I, you know, when I say some of the things I say, I probably would be accused of personal bias. And that may be true because I have, you know, she doesn't like me, and I certainly, you know, don't feel any closeness to her. And although I sincerely say that I would be very happy to work with her and be of whatever help I could if she felt that I could, but I don't think she's ever going to feel that way, and that perhaps gives me a feeling of some little frustration. In the past, I've worked with governors that I had not supported in primaries, Brown, and to a certain degree with Governor Ford, who, on the whole, though I'm in retrospect critical of some aspects of his administration, treated me personally very well, and I feel, first starting with the political side of it, which is probably not the most important, but is pretty vital, she's played a very different role and taken a very different tack on the political side of things than that which Ford took. And I think of the Ford administration because that's where she got her beginnings politically. And that was another occasion on which I had been on the losing side in the primary. I was very active in the Combs campaign and very close to Governor Combs. But after the primary, Ford and Mr. Miller made every effort to conciliate our side. They went to Combs right at the start, and they got him engaged in the campaign to a considerable degree. They had me out on the stump, and I worked very hard in that campaign, worked very closely with Miller. I stayed on the State Central Committee all during the Ford administration. Not that this was a matter of vital importance, but they retained me in several legal matters to represent them in cases in court. So I never felt that there was any policy of exclusion and isolation at that time, and Ford and Miller, whatever some of the faults of the administration may have been, probably built the party organization to its highest peak of effectiveness that it had been in a long time. And it really was during that administration and that regime that the factional divisions that had riven the party for years and even generations were obliterated. We don't have factions in the way we used to, where you had a Clements faction and a Chandler faction, or a Combs faction and a Chandler faction in every county. Those factions, you may have local factions revolving around local leaders, but you don't have statewide factions. In many ways, the Democratic Party was for generations two parties in Kentucky, kind of like two clans. But really, that was sort of wiped out during the Ford administration. Now, I don't say that Martha Lane has revived exactly factionalism, but I think she has isolated herself politically from the party or that portion of the party that wasn't intimately involved with her own primary campaign. And since she was not supported by the most active leaders in the party, who either were for Stumbaugh or Sloan, and since she only got the vote of one-third of the people that voted in the primary, this has left her administration in some respects, I think, politically isolated and has impaired her effectiveness. Then carrying that into the administrative structure of state government, I think she has done somewhat the same thing. She has appointed mostly people who have had no experience in state government, who have had no wide experience in politics, and who are sort of strangers to the situation. I mean, who ever heard of Mack Thompson? Who ever heard of Gary Gillis? Who ever heard of most of these cabinet members that she has named? Who ever heard of Al Austin? I mean, people around Frankfurt did, because he'd been around for years as a sort of survivor. I suppose the nearest to an appointment she made in her cabinet that had any political standing or significance was Charlotte Baldwin, who in a local way had been mayor of Madisonville and attained some prominence, and Carol Nicely, who had been in state government before and had during the time he was a publisher down in Glasgow, had had some active connection with politics, but not really a whole lot. So that has given her what I would call sort of an isolated administration. They're all new faces. And Brown had new faces in a sense, but they were people of more force and significance than the people that she's appointed. Now, as to her policies, I can't see what policies she's had. She had a tax program in the legislature, which she didn't come to till after the session. She reversed course in the middle of the session, which is always a risky thing to do, and it was a bust. It was partly a bust because she wasn't willing to go out and fight for it, or didn't know how to go out and fight for it, or didn't have the temperament to go out and fight for it, and because she didn't have the skill to lobby for it in the legislature. The only chance she had to secure what she wanted from the legislature in the way of taxes would have been either to deal with them on a political basis, which she lacked the skill to do, or the, even the drive to do, or to go out on the hustings and seek to create enough sentiment to bring pressure on legislators. And that's always hard to do when a tax program is sprung in the middle of a session. And but even with the difficulties, she might have had a shot at it if she had been willing to go out and sort of lay herself on the line for it. But she didn't. She went around and spoke to a couple of PTA meetings, which is sort of like going to a prayer meeting and asking people not to get drunk. Now, all that gave it an ineffective start. And I don't think her role at the Democratic National Convention or some of the other things she's done has really given her any greater degree of strength and security in her base here in Kentucky. I suppose just the fact that she's there has made people a little more used to her, but I don't think that her presence is vividly felt. I don't think that people think of her as a leader in this state. It comes very close to my mind to approximating a sort of perpetual vacancy in the office. Now, that may be a harsh judgment, and it may be a biased judgment. And if so, it has to be, because I have searched my mind as best I could to find a more favorable conclusion, but I just can't get beyond what I have said.
What about our most recent efforts on behalf of education?
Well, I think they're well-intentioned. I don't think she really has demonstrated any real grasp of the issues.
I think there's genuine commitment there?
It's hard to say. I think insofar as she's capable of genuine commitment, there's a commitment there. And as far as anything public is concerned, I have tried to give evidence of supporting her and praising her for her commitment. But it's hard for me to think of commitment in compare, when I compare the efforts she's made with the efforts that people like Governor Clinton, Governor Winter, and Governor Graham, and Governor Riley, and Governor Hunt, and Governor Alexander made. I mean, the effort hasn't been there. Now, I think to say she doesn't have a commitment is perhaps to expect more of her than it's possible to extract, because I'm not sure that she has a temperament that is capable of commitment to anything. I think her main commitment was to be nominated for governor and elected governor, and once she fulfilled that commitment, I don't know whether she has any other commitment. She, like all governors, she alleges a commitment to industrial growth, economic growth, and I'm sure she has that commitment, in a sense. Nobody's against that. But I believe that, to a considerable degree, that the economic development and the course of economic conditions in Kentucky is far more likely to be determined by the trends in the national economy and by long-term economic trends in Kentucky than it is by what a governor does. I don't say that a governor couldn't do things so horrible that they retard the economic growth of the state, or couldn't do things so well that they help. But I think most governors exaggerate the degree to which they, indeed I think Governor Brown exaggerated the degree to which a governor can have affected basic economic conditions of the state. We have conditions in Kentucky that are permanent, semi-permanent, and that are very ominous. The main bases of our economy in Kentucky are all under attack and are all eroding. Coal is in trouble, tobacco's in trouble, whiskey's in trouble, the thoroughbred business is about to get in trouble. Our manufacturing base is shrinking, and all those things. And we are not educationally prepared and scientifically prepared for the era of the service economy and the high technology economy. We haven't got the educational base for it, because it's primarily an information economy. It's primarily an economy based on intellectual resources rather than natural resources. And we haven't got them. And that's why education, I'll just go into that part of it now, that's why education is a vital component, if not the most vital component, of our industrial and economic progress and development. And we have not got a commitment to a first-rate, broad-based research university. She's trying, I think, to improve the quality of the public schools. She's done absolutely nothing about higher education. And the research capabilities of the state. Higher education is way out on a limb, and the limb is very weak. Neither the higher education establishment itself, nor the legislature, nor the governor, nor the Council on Higher Education have made the faced the basic problems and made the basic decisions that are required if we're going to have a system of higher education that brings us into the 21st century prepared for the kind of economic problems and challenges we're going to face. And I think that the things on which we have depended, we cannot abandon, like tobacco and coal, liquor and horses, and manufacturing, but they're not going to employ as many people, furnish as many jobs, or give us the broad base that they furnished us in the past. We need to preserve them, restructure them, but we've got to find new outlets for our energies, and new energies to create new outlets. And I don't see the leadership there. Now, I wish I could find somebody to make the contrary case, because I should like to believe something different. I should like to take a more optimistic view of her administration.
Well, what's your view of her statement that she will pursue building public sentiment for education reform, but leave the tax raise to the legislature, which indicates she'll not take any hand in that?
Well, that just means that, you know,
how do you interpret that?
That means she's going to try to lead the horse to water, but not make him drink, I reckon. I don't know. It seems to me that the revenue question is so intimately tied to educational reform that it's sort of Hamlet without the prince. How are you going to reform education without paying for it? There are some things you can do, and we've already done most of them, or begun to do some of them. But let's start taking the things. Everybody thinks that the only call for revenue would be for teachers' salaries. But teacher salaries are not the only educational reform that would require additional revenue. If you were going to have an adequate kindergarten program, we've got a kindergarten program on paper, but we don't have the financing for it. We have not financed reduced class sizes to the degree that reduction is needed. We have not financed remedial education beyond the second grade. We have done nothing about what I think is probably the hardest problem of all to solve in dealing with Kentucky's peculiar situation, namely the fact that we're a state now that's pervasive in its ignorance and educational deficiencies, that we have low per capita income, we have a low rate of literacy, we have a high rate of high school dropouts, we have a low rate of college attendance, a low grade of college graduation, and that ignorance begets ignorance, education begets education. That is a cycle of poverty and deprivation that must be broken, and that has to start with early childhood education, the most critical phases of it. If we're going to break that cycle and bring up to adequate levels of ability to learn those children who come from deprived, uneducated and backward homes to a state where they go to school equipped to learn, because I think that the performance of children in school is to a considerable extent predestined by what takes place in their homes and their lives and their communities before they ever walk in the schoolhouse door.
Hold it. Side two. Picture interview.
Mm-hmm.
They were ready to go.
What, got it?
Yeah.
In other words, I think the key to Kentucky's particular situation is early childhood education, which may begin from the time of birth, as I said to the State Board of Education, between the womb and the first grade. And that's enormously expensive. It would involve a full financing of the Head Start program. It would involve moving the Head Start program down to the 3-year-olds. It would involve a drastic improvement in the kindergarten program, and it would involve some type of attempts to stimulate educational activity in the home by some outside intervention at the earliest months of life. Such simple things as whether there's somebody to read to a child, somebody to draw for a child, somebody to teach a child to sing, to show them beautiful pictures. There's an enormous difference between the educational potential of a child who walks in the first grade, already taught to read, already knowing what addition and subtraction are, already having seen beautiful works of art, already having learned songs and verses, already having been taught maybe to spell a little bit, already being familiar with the world of books. Just, I'm talking about not geniuses or anything like that, but just what the ordinary middle class child has gone through before he goes to school. And the child who goes simply out of a home where none of those influences have been brought to bear. And that is where your dropouts start. That's where your slow learners are made. It's what I call, and some of my friends among the social workers don't like it, I call it the crippled children syndrome. And that'll take money. It certainly will take money to give us a first class comprehensive research university. To say that one is for educational reform, but is going to leave the financing of that reform to somebody else, is, as I said, like playing Hamlet without the prince. And I think we made a good deal of progress in the last session of the legislature toward accountability, and those types of reform that center on and revolve around accountability. Although I'm not sure we have chosen the right tools to obtain accountability, we've gone on now on a great binge of making test scores the test of educational effectiveness, and I think that's bunk. I think that's a form of discrimination. I think value added is the best test of educational performance. What the teacher or the school gets in the form of raw material and what value it adds to that raw material. And you can't judge that simply by judging the value of the output at the end of the process. You got to judge what the value was at the beginning of the process and how much has been added to it or subtracted from it. Do I make that clear?
Yes.
You know, a teacher who took a bunch of little black children or a bunch of little mountain children who came of illiterate parents and walked in the second grade with little or no attainment and added X, Y, or Z to the attainment with which they came in the classroom is a far more effective teacher than one that took a bunch of bright, well-scrubbed children who'd been read to and sung to and been around the stimulus of educated parents and came in and added little or nothing during that year. And I think that's one of the things our committee,
like the Free Preacher said,
is devoting a great deal of its attention to, is what are the criteria of effective schools.
Okay.
Got it?
Yeah.
And I think the nearest criterion that we've been able to come to yet, although we're still working on it, is that of value added. What has the school, what has that particular teacher, what has that particular school added to the intellectual and educational attainments of the children? And it's perfectly obvious that in a place like Lexington, the fact that they have high test scores doesn't prove a damn thing, because they ought to have high test scores. Hell, they've got university professors for parents. A lot of them, I don't mean that literally, but on the other hand, if the test scores in a county like Jackson or Leslie are bound to be low because the education and attainment of the parents are low. And the question is, how much can you overcome that in the school? Now and then the next most critical issue, it seems to me, in education is, what are you driving for? Are you driving for and striving for specific job-related training at the elementary and secondary level? Are you driving for broad preparation for citizenship, life in the community, and sharing in the heritage of our society, an ability to express oneself and to use the language coherently to express and relate to ideas and concepts, whether mathematical or poetic, rhetorical, historical, or otherwise? And of course, that is the kind of education that I think is important, not only from the standpoint of personal development and the standpoint of participation in a democracy, the health of a society, but it's important from the standpoint of vocational choice, because the average career comprehends four or five different kinds of jobs. And you prepare for one type of job, we trained welders for 30 years in this nation and this state, long after we didn't need any more welders. We had VOAG courses long after the number of farmers was shrinking every year. Specific vocational training at the elementary and secondary level is, in my opinion, of dubious value. So the second thing I would emphasize on education is the importance of what I call broad liberal education for everybody. And I don't believe there's some just fit for it and some not fit for it. I believe it's, in a democracy, it's important for everybody. But You know, I don't find, you talk about Governor Collins and educational reform. I find no real evidence that she grasps any of these things, or that she really, I think she's never gotten beyond just a few bromides.
Have you ever had an in-depth conversation with her on the subject of education?
I've never had an in-depth conversation with her on any subject.
Have you ever had a conversation with her?
Oh, perfunctorily, yes. But no more than perfunctorily. I find it very hard to penetrate her exterior. I find it very hard to get inside her. I don't believe she reveals herself or likes to reveal herself very much. Now, I don't know how she is with people to whom she's close, because I've never been that close to her. But I've never felt ever in her presence that she let her hair down or opened up. And I don't think that has anything to do with her being a woman, because I have, you know, literally dozens and hundreds of active women friends who give an entirely different impression to me.
So you don't really know whether she agrees with you or not, basically.
Oh, you know. What was it? There used to be a little nursery line about Mother Goose had a son named Jack, a plain-looking lad. He was not very good and not very bad. I don't know that she ever agrees or disagrees with anybody very much. I never find much evidence of any strong feeling or conviction that she has on any side of any question.
Well, given that fact, and the fact that she's not going to support, or not going to provide leadership for a financing of educational reform, do you see any real hope for substantive reform in the next Dennis administration?
Oh, I suppose if you could get a procession moving, she might be willing to. You know, what was it? There goes the mob. I must march at the head. I'm their leader. I must follow them because I'm their leader. I don't know. I think if the crowd ever got big enough, she might march at the head of it. But she'd have to be sure it was a winning issue.
What about Alice McDonald?
Well, I think Alice is...
Is she receptive to your...
Much more. I think Alice is a much sharper-edged instrument than Martha Lane. I think Alice, and I'm going to say that I think Alice has a conniving side to her. Alice has a hard, ruthless side to her. But I think Alice is extremely bright and energetic and willing to take some risks. And I think, in general, she's committed to the right. I think she's going to, you know, to some extent, cover her tracks and protect herself. But I think she's committed. I think Alice feels that her chance is through leadership. I think, in a sense, the contrast is very great. You know, Alice doesn't have the sort of soft feminine appeal that Martha Lane seems to have for some people. Alice has a hard, cutting edge, and And you know, I think she's rather calculating. But I think she's shrewd enough to realize that you have to take some risks. And I think she's bright enough to understand what the issues are. And I'll offer you an example. She was elected with the support of KEA. Vital financial support as well as political support. But I think she has been very careful, don't you, to keep herself at a moderate distance from being viewed as just a KEA puppet.
Yes.
I think she has very skillfully managed to keep them from breaking with her. But she has been far from her. Well, just take the career ladder. I know Alice is walking on tender feet in that issue, but she's pretty clearly committed to the career ladder. And as far as I can see, the KEA is still adamantly opposed to any concept of a career ladder. And indeed, the KEA has been a great disappointment to me. I've always been on their side. I believe in collective bargaining or professional negotiations, whatever you want to call it. I've always believed in it. I believe in public employee unions. I think if I were an employee in the public sector, whether in education or anywhere else, I think I would want an organization to represent me and try to negotiate for me. But I think the KEA has some of the weaknesses of all the current trade union thinking, which is to view their interests in excessively narrow terms. And they seem to me to fear educational reform when they should be embracing it. Very much in the same way that some labor unions were hostile to productivity measures and things of that sort. I think the KEA has a deep suspicion of anything that tends to emphasize qualitative differences in the teaching force or profession. I don't say that out of hostility, because the concept of teacher organization is one that I favor. I think the KEA and teachers associations have over the years done a great deal of good, but I think they are not adjusting to some of the current challenges as they should. And by the way, I am not terribly encouraged by Martha Lane's Commission on Educational Reform. I have a feeling that the commission is not becoming deeply engaged in issues. I have a feeling that Ray Nystrand's going to write the report and they're going to rubber stamp it. Hell, they've only had one meeting, I think, or maybe two. You might check that, Big.
I will. What's Nystrand's background?
Well, I've forgotten where he comes from.
But he's not there because he's an educator, is he?
Yes. Oh, yes, he's dean of the College of Education at the University of Louisville. I don't think he had any great connection with her before the...
Well, I somehow got the impression his main role was to blunt Secretary McDonald.
That's true, but he's leaving at the end of the year. I think that was his role. She promised Alice McDonald that she would not name a Secretary of Education unless she named her, that she'd either not name one or name Alice. And Alice was much embittered when she named Nystrand, but I don't think Nystrand has had that much impact. I think his main impact has been working with this committee. He was, I think, probably recommended to her by the superintendent in Louisville, who seems to be playing his own game on all this stuff. Ingerton, or whatever his name is. Nystrand is not a fool. He's a fellow. A good deal of what he says is very sensible. But he's not, you know, coming from a college of education, he's bound to have sustained some of the crippling effects of that ambience.
Well, let's move to higher education just a minute, talk about the discussion of merger.
Well, my first comment on that is merger for what? It's like saying you're for a single governing board for all the universities. Is the answer to be found in structures or in decisions? There are certain decisions we need to be made that need to be made in higher education. And changes in structure are beneficial only if they help to bring about a better making of those decisions. And I have to be convinced that change in structure will do any more than leave the same old issues to be resolved in a different forum. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think we're talking about a lot of personalities right now.
Well, but you know, if you're talking about personalities, Singletary is not going to be here but another year or two, a couple of years. I'm not sure how long Swain's going to be here. Swain is a very ambitious man. He's a much more astute man than Singletary, a much more effective man than Singletary. But I'm not sure that he's going to stay in Louisville all that time. I think he's more ambitious than that. And I'm beginning to hear comments about him around Louisville that are not as laudatory as the original assessments, that he's manipulative. But I don't know. I'm not close enough to University of Louisville situation lately to know. I was much impressed by him when I met him, and still retain that impression to a considerable degree. But the real question about merger of those two institutions is not just one of personalities. It's one of who's going to do what and with which and to whom.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm saying right now in the initial stages it seems to me it's a matter of personalities will rule.
Well, Singletary and Swain were the people that initiated the idea of merger. The first conversations I ever heard about it in a serious way since Earl Clements, who advocated it way back before the University of Louisville ever came into the state system, because he foresaw what was going to happen to that university. And he was rebuffed by the Louisville establishment. But the next time it came to be, Considers was in the mid-60s, and I was on a committee representing the Council on Higher Education, and we came very close to it, and the props got kicked from under that, really, because of Oswald's departure. We were very close to agreement. But then the University of Louisville began to put a lot more goodies on the tree. They bought the Kentucky Southern campus, for instance, and took on that School of Music out there at the Norton Estate. And they began to frighten University of Kentucky. And so that was abandoned, I guess, in around 1967.
What was the elements of that agreement that was almost achieved?
Well, it was just to have a single Commonwealth university with two campuses, a chancellor, a president, and two chancellors, a single board. But really, we never got to the substantive question again of what we were still in the period of expansion then. And the question of allocation of resources was not so urgent. And the University of Louisville at that time was not in the state system. You know, we didn't come into the state system till 1970. And then when they got in the state system, they got in all virtually unconditionally. And the bargaining chips went the other direction. And it looked for a while, since Jefferson County was gaining so much in population and legislative representation, with the one man, one vote principle of constitutional law, it looked like University of Louisville had all the cards in its hand. But since then, the situation's been changed. The community colleges have grown. Population of Jefferson County has remained static. We're now thinking, you know, enrollments are not on the rise. We're now dealing with such things as two huge, since then, this huge medical center has been built at the University of Louisville, which makes an enormous difference. Indeed, I'm not sure that the critical issue of merger isn't how it's to affect the operation of the two medical centers. Because if you look at where the money goes, there's a whole lot of it goes into those two medical centers and those two hospitals.